Hello and welcome everyone to session 2 of our Teaching Peace in Schools, Cultivating Restorative Schools Community Summit. My name is Matthew Albrecht. I'm one of the directors of the Peace Alliance. We're co-hosting the summit and the follow-up course along with the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice. We just really couldn't be more excited to have so many of you here with us tonight for this incredibly important conversation. We believe the topics we're covering during the summit are so crucial. We hope that this can be a real kickoff to a broader national and global conversation, a movement really, on how we can and should infuse these skills of peace and peace building into our schools. Our theme for this session is bringing social and emotional learning and nonviolent communication into the classroom. This follows up a great first day of the summit, which focused primarily on restorative justice practices. That took place in session 1, and if you haven't heard it yet, you can hear it on our website. It's really good. So for this session, we're going to hear from some truly extraordinary catalysts who are working to help make this all a reality. First, we're going to hear from Congressman Tim Ryan, who's the author of the Academic and Social and Emotional Learning Act in Congress, and a real expert on this field. That will be followed by Jim and Jory Mansky of NVC for the Next Generation. They are so inspiring. You don't want to miss them. And then after that, you'll all be invited and encouraged to participate in the conversation by submitting questions. Lots of great questions, I'm sure, will be coming in. And then finally, at the close of today's session, you'll hear about our upcoming related course, which we're really excited to launch next Wednesday. So now I'd like to introduce our first speaker, give you a little background on him, who we're just so honored to have join us, Congressman Tim Ryan. Unfortunately, as you'll hear, part of his audio was lost in this recording from a tech glitch. So his portion starts up a few minutes after he started. We really apologize for that, but there's still a lot of inspiring sharing. Congressman Ryan was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2002. And is currently serving his 7th term representing Ohio's 13th Congressional District. Of particular interest for us, Congressman Ryan is the author and lead sponsor of the Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning Act of 2015. This bill defines social and emotional learning and its programming. It identifies core areas of social and emotional competency and amends the Elementary and Secondary Education Act to allow funding for teacher and principal training and professional development to be used for SEL program. Parts of it were included in the big education bill that passed Congress recently and was signed into law, which is a real victory for social and emotional learning. So for those of you who aren't aware, social and emotional learning is the process through which children acquire and effectively apply the knowledge, attitudes, and skills necessary to understand and manage emotions, set and achieve positive goals, feel and show empathy for others, establish and maintain positive relationships, and make responsible decisions. So, SEL programming in schools is based on the understanding that the best learning emerges in the context of supportive relationships that make learning challenging, engaging, and meaningful. And it really helps kids have more depth and understanding in their lives. And it's a beautiful piece of teaching in schools. So Congressman Ryan also has a daily mindfulness meditation practice and has been an outspoken advocate for promoting mindfulness as an aid to dealing with a variety of complex problems facing the nation. He's the author of the book, A Mindful Nation, How a Simple Practice Can Help Reduce Stress, Improve Performance, and Recapture the American Spirit. He currently resides in Howland, Ohio, and his wife Andrea, with his wife Andrea and their 3 children. So with that, we begin with Congressman Tim Ryan, already in progress, and it's just a really inspiring conversation.
Neighborhoods and families and households that make this difficult, where they don't learn these skills, and so having this infused into the curricula, I think, is critically important to give them the opportunity. You know, we know that 75% of what a kid learns comes through modeling. And, you know, how does a kid end up going down the wrong road? Well, they don't have a good model. So if we can have these approaches being modeled by teachers and coaches and principals and staff in the schools, these kids are going to learn, how to act the appropriate way. And so the SEL programming is based on the understanding that the best learning emerges in the context of supporting relationships that make learning challenging and engaging and meaningful. And the benefits of SEL, I think, go far beyond the classroom, which is key, preparing students for future roles, as we talk about politics and citizenship, to be good employees or employers or good managers or parents or volunteers or coaches or entrepreneurs. These are essential skills that they need, and we're moving, and these kids are moving into an increasingly competitive world. There's a need to equip students with these skills necessary to be knowledgeable, responsible, and caring adults. So this legislation defines SEL and allows for federal funding to support SEL programs, teacher training in SEL to help young people better handle societal issues, which in turn boosts their academic potential. And those of us who've been doing this for a while, and I think really anybody with a little bit of common sense recognizes that if you have the ability to self-regulate, to be self-disciplined, to manage your own emotions, you're going to boost your academic potential as well. And research shows that students exhibit more pro-social behavior, fewer problem behaviors, and less emotional stress. And research has also shown that students with SEL score up to 11 percentile points higher on standardized achievement tests, which really closes the achievement gap. So we're seeing, I think, more clearly that, we talk about testing and we talk about academics, and what we're seeing, and I think what the research is starting to bear out, is that teaching kids how to regulate and handle their emotions is key to then boosting the academic performance. So, we're seeing that happen. They're doing better on tests, they're showing greater social behaviors, less emotional stress, and are far less likely to engage in the kind of problem behavior, alcohol and drug use, violence, truancy, bullying, the whole nine yards. So even the CDC has said students who feel more connected to school are more likely to have positive health and education outcomes. And the CDC report shows that a close relationship between the emotional welfare and health of a student can create a safer and more secure environment for learning. And the CDC, again, recommends that schools provide students with academic, emotional, and social skills necessary to be actively engaged in the school. So I was proud, as was mentioned in my introduction, that we were able to include some language from my bill into the Elementary and Secondary Education Reauthorization Act, which was the law that replaces No Child Left Behind. This legislation emphasized school climate and environments, and allow formula funding to fund evidence-based strategies like SEL to improve academic success. So that was a big, big win for us to get that language into the bill, and that's what happens a lot in Washington. You have a bill that has many different components, and you're able to get some of that bill into a bigger bill that's actually moving and passing, and we were able to do that and really start to get some resources behind these SEL programs. And As all of you know, most of you know anyway, that these competencies aren't soft skills. They're foundational for all these other skills that kids need. And if we want a tolerant society, a compassionate society, we need to teach these skills that create strong social and emotional bonds with kids. So let me just say lastly, I've seen this in my own district. We were able to get some money a few years back for social and emotional learning programs in our schools in Warren, Ohio. And, I go to the school often every couple months and check in and see what's going on. And I was at one of the schools a month or two back, and this particular school has seen a reduction of more than 70% of out-of-school suspensions. Attendance rates have increased. There was an increase in instructional time since there was less destructive behavior, and many of the teachers were saying that they were, because the climate of the school, the culture of the school has changed, they're starting to really see the educational piece come online, and they're starting to see improvements in reading and math and other areas, because it's over the last 4 or 5 years, again, they're into wraparound services. They have peer mediation, but the SEL was really the catalyst. The quiet time that they take is really the catalyst to say, hey, how do we begin to handle these kids in a different way? And we start to be agents of de-escalation instead of agents of escalating the problem. So I'm super excited about, you know, where this is moving. I believe that, you know, along with healthy food in our schools, that these kind of contemplative practices and social emotional learning, as well as the food, are really the common core moving forward. I mean, we have to redefine what the common core is. It's a big discussion happening now with the presidential race. And I just think that, you know, if you don't have healthy food in our schools, where these kids have a balanced diet, high energy levels, eating fresh fruits and vegetables, keeping them away from the highly processed foods, and then you're teaching them how to calm themselves down, to relax, to reduce their stress, to increase their focus, attention, and awareness. You know, if they don't have that, the academics are never going to come online. If they do have that, the academics will come online, and at the very least, if they don't thrive academically, they're still going to be good people, good citizens, and good participants in society. And so I think, to me, that's ultimately what's most important. So I'm thankful for all of your work, and I look forward to working more and more with you as we move forward. I really do believe we're building a big coalition around the country. I think there are millions and millions of people who are interested in this, who are pushing this and promoting it. But I also think there are many, many more millions of parents in our society that if we get the message out, this just makes sense to them, that this would be foundational, that this would be part of a new common core that's emerging in the country. So thank you so much, and I'm happy to hang out for a few minutes and take some questions.
That would be inspiring. Thank you so much for articulating it. I just want to quickly share that this is Congressman Tim Ryan that we're speaking with. We've had a backlogged call-in system, and some folks are getting on late, so just wanted to preface that. And we're having a really inspiring conversation about social and emotional learning. And I'm curious, Congressman, if you is the bill got some components passed that you have in Congress. What is the appetite in Congress for this kind of work? Is there a growing awareness and interest in allowing things like this into the Common Core, into our educational policy?
Well, I think bits and pieces. You know, we were able to get this in, so there's some support. We were able to get a really good push from some of the parents that were involved in the Sandy Hook shooting. Coincidentally enough, and ironically enough, everything that happened there, the state of Connecticut went on to evaluate, you know, maybe what they could do better. From statewide policies, and I think one of the top three positions or recommendations that the commission came up with was social emotional learning in the schools. And there were parents there. The mother of Jesse Scott was instrumental in helping us push this, and she was working with Senator Blumenthal on the Senate side to get this pushed in. So, you know, again, you know, you don't always need, you know, broad consensus. You just need key legislators who can maybe, you know, push this stuff in to bills like the one we got it in. So, you know, we're still trying to, you know, get it more mainstream. I mean, I think it's mainstream, but more people in Congress and in legislative bodies aware of it, but at the same time, you know, we're still able to, I think, get things moving. And to me, that's what's really exciting about it, that we have this approach and opportunity that's happening. I'm sorry, the name Scarlett Lewis, the Jesse Lewis Foundation, out of Connecticut, and Scarlett Lewis is his mom, and she was just so instrumental in helping us move this. So again, you know, the point that I think I made, you know, last time I spoke to your group, and now again, you know, a small key group of people can get this stuff done, and this was a mission for Scarlett Lewis. She worked her senators. She took a very negative, tragic situation and tried to get some positive stuff happening with it, and we were able to get this in, and so now we take the next step to try to expand it, get more money behind it, get more awareness, get it in the teacher training, get it in the after school programs, summer school programs, so that, you know, ultimately what we want to happen is the same language that's being used in the schools, the same technique that's being used in the schools will be used after school in the after school program. And then you have a parental component so that the parents are using the same language as the teachers of helping kids de-escalate. And then when they go to summer school or summer camp, those teachers are also trained and the language is infused into, you know, what they're saying. And so it becomes a way of being and teaching these kids how to be in the world and really to continue to reinforce these techniques.
That's great. That's so great. I want to just remind people, if you have any questions, you can submit for Congressman Ryan right now. You can submit them on the web page in the tool to write a question. Or you can also hit *2 on your phone, and we'll take a few questions before the congressman leaves, or one or two maybe. You're a practitioner, I know, of mindfulness, and I know you're familiar with some of what's going on in schools. A lot of our network really appreciates that kind of learning. We've seen so much positive indicators of the effectiveness of mindfulness practices in schools. Is there anything about that you'd be up for sharing, maybe describing to people what that's like?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's the same kind of approach, but it's, to me, it's the technique that can really, really be helpful. As Jon Kabat-Zinn says, you know, we yell at kids to pay attention, but we don't ever teach them how to pay attention. And the really mindfulness and other contemplative practices are really the how to pay attention. And so I think they're essential. Awareness practices, attention practices are really essential and to me are a major component of a well-rounded social and emotional learning curriculum because, you know, you need to have these kids continuing to become more and more aware, cultivate their own awareness, and pay attention to what's going on inside of them, especially if they're in these violent homes or violent neighborhoods. You know, they've got to create more space between stimulus and response, and these practices help cultivate that space between stimulus and response, and that's essential to making good decisions, you know, to have that just that half a beat that you need before you do something stupid. And as I mentioned, you know, the city schools where we have the social emotional learning, and they also have a quiet time where they do belly breathing and they do body relaxation and mindfulness type practices. Of the 60% or 70% reduction in out of school suspensions, they have a student support center in the school. And I think they were telling me about half of the kids who end up going to the student support center are self-referrals, meaning that these kids catch themselves and raise their hand and ask the teacher if they could leave before they do something stupid. And they end up going down to the student support center. There can be a psychologist down there. There can be peer mediators down there. But the point is they are becoming more and more aware, and so they take themselves out of these bad situations. And I think mindfulness practices, attention practices, awareness practices give them that space to say, oh, shit, you know, I'm going to push someone, I'm going to punch someone, I'm going to do something that I shouldn't be doing, and I need to get myself out of this situation. So I was just so heartened by that because I think that to me is saying that the program is really getting ingrained into the culture of the school, and the kids are really starting to understand what they're being taught, and they're removing themselves from the situation. And I think that's to me the really critical component of the mindfulness practice, of the awareness practice, because then they're starting to take it and use it on their own without someone telling them what it's going to feel like or look like or be like. They're already understanding that, and that's saving them a lot of problems.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Thank you for that. That's very important. We do have a question in that I'll ask. It says, what ways does a, if you can't answer any of this, parts of this, it's fine. But what ways does a school start to implement SEL practices? What does it require? Who's involved? What's taught and shared? Some of that.
Well, you know, every school's different. So, you know, sometimes a superintendent can spearhead it and say, you know, we're going to try to, you know, grow this thing in the school. And sometimes they pick different school buildings and they say, okay, this is, you know, K-1, 2, 3, you know, K first grade, second grade, third grade in this one school, and we're going to try to do it in the whole school, and we're going to start it in the whole school. Sometimes they say we're going to start it with all the kindergarten classes, and then the next year we're going to do first grade and kindergarten. The next year we'll do second, first, and kindergarten and grow it that way. Other times it's just an inspired teacher or an inspired counselor who kind of pieces it together with, you know, shoestring and bubble gum and brings it into their classroom, and they may have a mindfulness practice, or they may, you know, have a background that drew them to social emotional learning, and they just start it in their own classroom. And then other teachers around that classroom say, hey, what are you doing in there? It used to be noisy, now it's quiet. You know, you used to be rambunctious, and now it seems like you're getting your work done. And then the other teachers start to get on board. So there's no one, you know, way to do it. I think, you know, it just needs to start wherever you are, you know, which is kind of ironic too, given that, you know, many people who support this are into mindfulness type practices. You know, you just kind of start where you are, and I think it needs to be very organic, and I really don't think it can always be top down. I think you, even if you are a superintendent who wants to get it rolling in the school district, you really do have to begin with the teachers that want to do it, that are inspired to do it. And I've heard a number of stories over the past few years where, even in our own school districts, where other teachers didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't want another thing on top of all the other stuff that they had to learn over the past few years. And then ultimately they see what's happening in the classroom and they ask, well, how come you didn't invite me to do this? And we say, well, we did invite you, but you didn't want anything to do with it. But now that they see how it's playing out, and I always felt like that once teachers were selling this to other teachers, that we were going to be in a really good place. And I think that's kind of where we're getting. It's not some hotshot congressman who's coming in saying, hey, you need to try this. I have a new idea for you teachers because, you know, you don't have enough that you're doing and, you know, you need me to tell you. It needs to be teachers who have experienced it, seen the transformation in the kids, see the culture of the school change, and then they say, hey, we should try this, or hey, you're a fellow teacher, you should try this. And so there's no one way of doing it. It's just about getting it introduced to people and inviting them to maybe learn more about it if they want, and if they don't, that's fine. But if people are inspired to do it, those are the ones that your organization or me or others who are into this need to support and help and get connected and plugged in and provide the support system that they need to get it moving. And then they'll be the agent of change, and they'll be the role model or the example or the leader in whatever school they're in, even if it starts with just one classroom.
That's great. That's so important. It's good for people to know that. And hopefully this summit and the ensuing course can help inspire and connect people with those tools to really get involved in their community and to learn more. And we're just really grateful for your time tonight. I know you've got to move on with your time, and we're so grateful for your leadership. It's an inspiration that somebody who cares so deeply about this stuff is one of our nation's leaders. And we look forward to continuing to work with you on it, and to keep all of ourselves plugged into this advocacy work for teaching this in schools. So thank you so much for your time, Congressman.
Yeah, no really no doubt great. About it. And if you guys want to, like, you know, follow me on Twitter, timryan.house.gov is my Twitter handle. And I try to, you know, tweet out and share articles and the latest research and different things that are coming out. So if you want to stay connected in that way, you know, please do it. It's timryan.house.gov. And,
that's,
you know,
great. And we have a great Facebook page too. You post a lot of good stuff on Facebook for anybody who's interested.
So yeah, we try to get the word out. And, you know, like I said, I think, well, you know what, my Twitter handle is at Rep Tim Ryan is my Twitter handle.
Ah, that's better. Yes, at Rep Tim Ryan. Great.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Great. We'll repeat that again later. Good. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Good, good. Thank you. Thank
right.
you.
Bye-bye.
Well, great. So we're going to move on now in this call series. I'm sorry for some of you that had a challenge getting into the system. I know there was some technical glitches, but glad you're getting on now. And we're going to move on now to our second set of speakers. And following that will be time for Q&A. So if you all want to, on the web page, our main web page, start posting your questions or get ready to later, we can have a great back and forth dialogue with the group. So looking forward to that. So our next speakers we're really excited to have them join us tonight, are Jim and Jory Mansky. They've been married and working closely together for over 37 years. As co-creators of PeaceWorks, they offer training, mediation, facilitation, organizational development, consulting, and mentoring. In June of 2008, they completed their year and a half term as inaugural leaders of the Global Community Circle for the Center for Nonviolent Communication, supporting the growth and well-being of communities in the worldwide CNBC network. Jory also served in the past as the interim director of CNBC and has served on the CNBC board of directors for 3 years. Through NBC for the Next Generation, they support youth in becoming effective, compassionate leaders by providing nonviolent communication programs that offer collaborative leadership skills that support awareness and care for universal needs to school students, school personnel, prospective teachers, parents, and community members. They also co-authored Pathways to Liberation and remain eager to discover new ways of supporting leadership and compassion. And we're just really excited to have you guys with us tonight. And we're looking forward to hearing your sharing. And just anything you want to share, too, about for those who aren't familiar with nonviolent communication, which there are probably quite a few, would be great. But please take it over, Jim and Jory. Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you think you're excited, you should feel my heart rate right about now. Very excited to be on the call and to listen to Congressman Ryan. And it's like hearing what he shared with us, it awakened in me like layers and layers and layers of both hope and despair, because I see what he is bringing to our Congress, this message of the importance of social emotional learning and mindfulness. It's like music to my ears. I just never thought I'd ever hear such a thing from a congressman, and I'm really, really touched to be sharing the platform with him today, and very grateful for this opportunity to share with you all a little bit about what lights me up, and that's nonviolent communication.
Yeah, I'm Jory here, and in a way, it's like a dream, not quite coming true, but becoming true, that lives so deep inside of me. And I'm so thrilled that the Peace Alliance has shifted some attention in this direction of our next generation and how do we build this composite of workable systems that really address our social and emotional needs right into our schools. It's the center core of the development of our next generation, and it's the teachers and the parents too who have such an influence on this. So I'm quite excited to be able to be part of this. We actually we learned of nonviolent communication from Marshall Rosenberg. We met him in the year 2000. He was doing a free, an operative word, I think, that also helps this particular program, a free training for mediators. We had been a part of one of the first restorative judicial programs in the country for several years. And boy, hearing an international mediator was quite exciting. And what I learned from him kind of knocked my socks off. And he pointed to certain things that I hadn't really connected to in terms of our universality and being able to connect to that to really see that we are connected. So that's one of the beautiful things about nonviolent communication.
Yeah, Marshall changed our lives. It was like Marshall had a way with words and was a very gifted educator. And I remember after just being with him for about 15 minutes, already sensing that my life was going through a fundamental shift. And as I was preparing for this call today, I was looking through one of Marshall's little pamphlets that he wrote called The Heart of Social Change. And this quote just leaped out at me as I was reading. This is from Marshall Rosenberg, the creator of nonviolent communication. He said, "I want the next generation of people around the world educated in a radically different paradigm and with skills for creating structures that support the new paradigm." And what that new paradigm is to me is a partnership paradigm. We've been working under a different kind of a paradigm of really looking at the world through a lens of what's right, what's wrong and what's right, who's right, who deserves what, and so forth. And Marshall offered a radically different paradigm focused not on moral judgment, but on value judgment. And in looking at the world in terms of who needs what right now. And so we've seen this come alive, not only with our own kids. We have a couple of kids. They were already almost adult when we became interested in nonviolent communication, but we were doing things very similar to NVC before that. But now we've seen it awaken in families and in with parents here in Hawaii, where we are blessed to live, and just see the power of having an intention to connect with one another at the level of basic human needs and how that is transforming families. And here's one really brief little story. We started doing parenting training, and I think training parents is a critical component for getting these skills across to the next generation, because along with teachers, parents are the biggest role models for our kids. So these parents were in our class one day, and they'd been with us for about 6 weeks, so they were well versed now in the basics, and we'd been covering empathy. And the mom reported that she'd had a rough day the day before, and that her four-year-old saw that her mom was in distress and came up to his mom and touched her on the knee very gently and said something like, "Mom, looks like you're having a rough day. Would you like a hug?" And hearing stories like that, to see how we don't really need to train the kids very much. They are all naturally proficient in these skills of connection. That we really want to awaken what's already inside them.
So nonviolent communication really points to our humanity, our individual and collective humanity. It's not trying to add something new. It's actually bringing forth a deeper truth of who we really are. So, and I know that because I watch little babies, you know, when they hurt, they cry. They cry for a reason, because something, they need something. And the kids who have that kind of warmth, I watched our own daughter be that way, our own children, just noticing. Have you ever noticed when one child begins to cry, especially when they're really young, that another one begins to cry because they're already connected emotionally. They're already connected in terms of that social connection already exists. So in some ways, I see the work that we're all looking to do is more like dusting off some of the structures that we've built within ourselves and the structures we've built as a reflection of that externally that actually separate us and actually give us this sense that we're unique and we're alone. And in terms of working with the kids in the schools in our next gen, what we found was it was so important to actually play games so that they would get engaged rather than this idea that now we're teaching them something else. Open up your head so we can fill it up or do it just this right way. We're actually helping them to play games so that they can learn that they're not that different. A lot of the kids feel so isolated and are reactive as a result of that. So that's one key piece that I see, that nonviolent communication really helps in many of the things that are being brought to this.
So one way that Marshall used to present kind of the distinctions around nonviolent communication that seems to really help people understand what we're talking about when we're talking about NVC, NVC being the shortcut way of saying nonviolent communication. He used two metaphors. One was the giraffe and one was the jackal. And so let's talk a little bit about jackal, because the jackal was the metaphor that Marshall used to talk about the way that many of us have been educated for the last 8,000 years or so. And it has to do with a quality of education about who's right and who's wrong and who deserves what and so forth. And if you think about jackals, and I've got nothing against jackals. I think jackals are kind of can be really warm and cuddly, and they're animals, and I like all animals and so forth. So this is just a symbol. Please don't take anything personal about jackals, because they're also our greatest teachers. But jackals are kind of low to the ground. They don't have very much perspective. And they also tend to be a part of a domination hierarchy where there's a top dog and a bottom dog. And the guy that finally gets to the top, he's worried all the time that another jackal is going to be scraping his way to the top and he's going to lose his place. And meanwhile, the jackals that are at the bottom of the pile, they're just getting by on scraps and building resentment along the way. So there's this built-in social inequality in a jackal-dominated world. And then Marshall offers a different way of looking at the world that he talked about giraffe. And so if you think about giraffes, one of the things that makes giraffes very unique is they have these super long necks, which gives them a quality of perspective. So they're able to actually make very clear observations about what's going on in their world. And so that's one thing. And also giraffes have the strongest heart of any land mammal. In order to pump the blood up that long, tall neck, you got to have a really strong heart. And so this is indicative of the fact that sometimes NVC is called the language of the heart. And the heart is that part of us which is the residence for our feelings and our needs. The feelings being the part of our experience that are like signals that let us know what's really important to us from moment to moment. And the other important aspect of the heart is our needs, these universal human qualities that are non-controversial. Every single person on the planet has the same needs, whether you live here in the United States or whether you live in Africa or Asia or Australia or South America or anywhere else. We all have the same common palette of feelings and needs. And then also another important clue about giraffes and how it relates to nonviolent communication is for us to really live in this kind of a world we're talking about, people need to be safe. And so giraffes are constantly on the alert in the wild for the presence of danger. And so they are very protective. In fact, because of their tall necks, the other animals on the savanna count on giraffes to know when it's safe to get their needs met. In other words, when they can bow their heads and drink water. And so in the event that a predator comes in and starts to attack, the giraffe will actually use these long, very heavy hooves to try to chase away the predator. But they'll never try to run after the predator to try to punish it in any way. It's just about protection. So this goes to some of the key components of nonviolent communication and how we're all working on opening up the heart.
There's a couple other things that I see the parallel with giraffes. They're actually quite vulnerable. When they go to drink at the waterfall, they actually have to spread their legs and lean down. And so the other giraffes really take turns watching each other. And it's like having each other's back. And we actually see that other animals wait until the giraffes come to the waterhole because there's a quality of trust that's built. They know that somebody's watching. And giraffes do have these huge hooves, but they don't try and hurt the lion. They're really, really strong. It's like a pendulum on their leg. They'll just kick it to go away, and they don't chase it. So they're really not trying to hurt each other. And giraffes never use their hooves on each other. They fight with their necks. They have conflict, but they fight with their necks, not to try and hurt each other. So the parallels are really quite strong. And I watched Natural Geographic movie once on giraffes, and I learned a couple of other things that are amazing. They eat something called acacia leaves that have thorns, and they sometimes get they have tongues, really agile tongues, to get around those thorns. So I like to think about nonviolent communication as literally a language that helps us get around the thorns. And they sometimes do get a thorn in their mouth. It's inevitable. And they've evolved an enzyme to dissolve the thorns. And I find very much nonviolent communication helps us to dissolve the thorns, to really deal with those moments of disconnection and come back to connection. So a lot of this of nonviolent communication is about intention. The intention to connect is huge. The intention to protect is huge. The intention to care for each other.
Yeah, so I noticed, Matthew, we've been already talking for, believe it or not, about 15 minutes, and I noticed I've got a little bit of a need for connection from you right now. I'm wondering how this is working for you.
It's so great to hear. I feel really full listening and learning all of this great stuff. And, you know, one thing that I'm curious about is in the schools, when you all take this into, like, a classroom, or I know you train others to do it, what does it look like? Like, what does it look like for the kids? Just take people through that, a little bit of that are trying to imagine what it might be like in a classroom.
Yeah.
When the kids are working on this.
Yeah. I mean, I like what Congressman Ryan said a little while ago. It's going to be different from every school in every school and every classroom. And it's going to be based on the context of that particular classroom. So with younger kids, we tend to focus on awakening these skills through games and activities and reading and so forth. As children get older, I know there are programs using nonviolent communication peer mediation with kids as young as the second or the third grade, where they're actually learning the application of these skills of nonviolent communication to work with one another in conflict. And then as they get older, there might be more left brain kind of components of teaching and practicing NVC the way you might do it with an adult. And so for me, the most important part of getting NVC into the classroom is offering it to teachers, administrators, and students. Marshall's vision of what a NVC education program would look like is really a whole systems approach where kids are having opportunities every day to practice nonviolent communication, that every conflict in the classroom is actually part of the laboratory of learning. And this is being guided because of the warmth and the curiosity and the presence of the teachers who have been well trained in nonviolent communication and who respond to conflict not with power over authority, but with power with empathy and trying to connect with what's going on, who needs what right now, how can we help in order to solve this conflict. And of course, the teachers can't do their jobs without a staff and an administration of support that is based on making sure that the teacher's needs are met so they can be experiencing well-being from the moment they get to work, so that every part of a nonviolent communication-based school will reflect the exact kind of structure that we want to see in the world, so that needs are the forefront. Are teachers getting what they need? What if I'm the administrator, the question that I'm asking every day is, how can I be more effective at making sure teachers are getting what they need. And if I'm a teacher in these classrooms, my thought upon getting to work is, what do my kids need today, and how can I support them in getting their needs met? And then if I'm a kid going to a nonviolent communication school, I'm just going to be like a sponge. I'm going to be absorbing this field of self-connection, honesty, and empathy, and it's just going to begin to imbue every aspect of my experience, creating a quality of safety in the classroom that allows me to learn things and to teach things, and to see that I'm actually a co-creator of this educational responsibility. And so for me, nonviolent communication is democracy in action, because rather than seeing children as somehow less than, we see them as equal partners in the educational process. In fact, whenever I've gone into the classroom or gone into a training session with teachers or administrators or other people, I'm pretty sure I'm the one who's doing the most learning. And I think it's because of my NVC training. I'm just wide open to find out, what have I missed so far, and how could I enrich my life? How can I make life more wonderful for myself so that I can make it more wonderful for others?
Yeah. I would just add that the most important way that kids learn, particularly social emotional skills, is by modeling. So supporting those teachers and the people who hang out with kids, their parents, and all the adults that actually kids are looking to figure out how to navigate this complexity of life, to actually help them to be able to model both the warmth, the empathy, and also the authenticity of the expressing the deeper truths, really expressing and pointing to what these basic needs are. And when we say needs, we're talking about a variety of needs, the physical, emotional, social, and mental needs. And I love that, actually, the senator, or actually the
representative,
excuse me, pointed to the food part, too. That's part of the physical needs, that when our physical needs aren't addressed, we're not really available to move on to the mental needs of learning and challenge and all the things that the schools have really been working hard to bring in. And so there's just been an imbalance here, and I'm really glad even that the government now is acknowledging that we need these social emotional skills.
And one last point for me is that I love when Congressman Ryan was talking about mindfulness. And I've been a practitioner of mindfulness for about 40 years or so, and I think it has helped me a little bit. And what I love about NVC and things like it is that it's like mindfulness off the cushion. So we have this precious 5, 10, 15, or 20 minutes each day when we can sit and really be with ourselves and come to this state of calm alert, where we're then ready to open our hearts and open our lives to what happens today. And then NVC gives us a toolbox to actually navigate off the cushion, so that when we're in traffic, or when another kid steals another kid's lunch, or when there's some bullying going on, that each of these kinds of incidents each day is seen not as something to avoid, but something to walk towards. Now, how can we resolve this conflict and find a way to get everybody's needs met in this situation? What can we do to connect about this so that we can figure out a way to make life more wonderful for everybody and escape from the illusion of scarcity into seeing that we all have enough, and enough love, enough empathy, enough authenticity, so that everybody can get their needs met and nobody has to pay? So I'll pause again here, Matthew, and see if there's any questions or anything coming up for you right now.
Well, I'm, again, just soaking this up. You guys are so masterfully sharing this information. I loved the nonviolence is democracy in action, nonviolence education. That was a powerful statement, and it made crystal clear sense. I think just keep going. I have some questions flowing in, but just please share any more that you think would be great perspective, and then we'll open it up.
I'd love to open it. Do you have more you want to say?
Well, I just had one. Yeah. I remember that someone asked a question of Congressman Ryan about, you know, what's the step-by-step of getting this into a school? And and I loved his answer. And I'm thinking of one thing I learned from Marshall about social change, because basically what we're talking about here is a radical quality of social change. I mean, when you think about changing an education system, as Marshall said, the key unit of education is language. So we're talking about really changing everything from the ground up. That one of the things I really treasure that Marshall taught me was that if we want to make these kinds of changes, we need to identify key allies in the schools. Who are the people that have the structural power that can actually begin to shift the social structure in a way that would meet more needs at less cost? Sometimes that's the principal, sometimes it's the superintendent, sometimes it's the member of the House of Representatives or some other official. But so that's step number one, is identify who in the system has the structural power that can exert the change that we would like. And then second step, and this is where Marshall kind of goes from a slightly different view, rather than going and getting a meeting with this person and selling them on the idea of now what's going to change everything for the better, Marshall's advice is we go and we get this meeting, and the first thing we do is we listen. We listen to the other person and celebrate with them everything that's already working well about their system. And then we open up the floor with empathy to find out what's not working well. What's not going the way you would like it to, principal or teacher or whoever. And then we listen with empathy. And then together we enter into a partnership with that teacher, that administrator, that superintendent. Now we brainstorm together, heartstorm together. What can we do? What resources can we bring to meet more needs at less cost?
That's powerful. Those are really pragmatic and handy things, I think, for a lot of the folks on this call really want to start to do this work in school. So that's great. And I'll just also remind people that Jim and Jory are both leading one of the sessions for our upcoming course, and they're going to go even deeper into this. And we have a question from – are you all ready for any of these questions?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm excited about that.
Good. Let me just first remind everybody who's on that if you want to ask questions, we have a couple of ways to do it. The first is through the tool on our website, which all of you got a link for. Just type it in there. Please do, if you're on the phone, you could push, let us know when you type it in that you're on the phone, and you can push *2 to raise your hand. Also, if we need to, we can take some callers who are just on the phone line as well, but we'll do that in just a minute. Let me start with this question. Congressman Ryan mentioned that we need to redefine our Common Core. Common Core is focused on the mental and testing modes. So much that art, creativity, and other modalities key to connection and understanding have been phased out almost entirely. In your view, how does communication help us reshape education and our overdrive towards testing and achievement?
Wow, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. And you ever notice that presenters always say, that's a great question? And that's because we need time to figure out how we're going to respond. So I'll just say one thing about testing is in this radical worldview that Marshall, as an educator, was really trying to promote, he saw that the strategy of testing had had a very important role to play, and it's a measurement tool, obviously. And most of the time, we think of a test as measuring the kid's mastery of a certain subject or topic or skill or something like that. In Marshall's view, a test is a measurement of the teacher. And so when we get feedback from our kids that they're not learning, that this is powerful feedback for us of how we can modify and shift our teaching methods to meet the needs of the kids. And then the next time we test, because of the connection we've gotten with the kids, we're going to find better ways of getting across the information that's so important to get. So testing becomes, rather than a one-way measurement, it becomes a two-way street of connection, so that we are using the test as a way to open up our ears and open up our hearts to meet more needs with less cost.
Yeah, in the world I want to live in, the test is not measuring the student or the teacher. It's actually pointing to feedback we need to improve our capacity to arrive where we want to arrive. And if we keep ourselves really centered only on information and measuring such extrinsic things, whether they, you know, have you gotten this yet? This extrinsic information, we're missing so much. I would really love for us to test the amount of engagement that our children have. That, to me, is one of the things I see so missing in schools. Kids aren't engaged. They don't feel a part of what's going on very much. And I guess I'm talking more around the middle school age, where the group that is the most challenging at this point in my experience of going into the schools. How do we measure that? What's the feedback our kids can give us about that so that we can be more connected and engaged with them?
And I love this notion of reframing the core competencies, because the root word for core is it's from French, and it has to do with the heart. So what's the real heart of things? And long before we had an educational system, we had a social system. And the heart of any social system is, how well is this social system doing at meeting the fundamental needs of its participants? And so that's how I'd love to reframe and reform our core, is let's take a look at who needs what right now, every day at school. From the moment that a kid arrives and opens the door to the school, are they greeted with warmth and cordiality and equality and respect? Are we giving the kids what we want to receive when we're in the role of authority? Are we displaying respect and cooperation towards the kids and engaging in a dance of equality and mutuality? Are we able to open our hearts that we as the adults, the so-called adults in a system, have just as much to learn from the children as they have to learn from us, and to enter into a true partnership, an educational partnership? That's the kind of core I'd like to create.
I'm concerned we didn't actually answer the question of what does language have to do with it? Why is that core, I think, was the question. And so I just want to acknowledge that language is an important part of how we communicate. And we react a lot to how we're communicating nonverbally. And we can't really read 100% what's going on just based on the visual feedback or even the auditory feedback. But when we can learn to speak from a place of authenticity with an intention to connect, if we can actually speak words that can help another person to resonate with their deeper experience, it shifts everything. We find out that we are together here, even if we're having different experiences. So I'm complete with that.
This is such rich information. Thank you both. Just keep going. There's some good questions coming in. Let's see, this one's from Lori. She's asking, are there some specific training tools and materials that schools can get to begin to learn to model and teach NBC in classrooms?
Yes, there's some great resources. One of our colleagues, Sura Hart, has written some books. One is called The Compassionate Classroom. And it's got curriculum right built into it. And another one is called the No Fault Zone. And it it's both a game and some curriculum materials. Marshall's book, Life Enriching Education, has some resources. We're so proud, at least I'm going to speak for myself. I'm so proud that I'm part of a network of about 400 certified trainers that are doing this kind of work all around the world, not everybody working on education. Some folks like Dominic, who was on the call the other day, focusing on restorative circles and so forth. But there's if you just Google or use DuckDuckGo or whatever you like, nonviolent communication and education, you'll find links to all kinds of stuff. But I really highly recommend Sura's Compassionate Classroom and as a way to get started with some ideas. Then as you, what I'm so excited about that I learned from Marshall is that part of Marshall's dream was that we all take NVC inside and make it our own. So rather than teaching Marshall's version of NVC, you teach your version of NVC. You teach what works in your life to create a quality of connection that inspires compassionate giving and receiving, which is the purpose of NVC in the first place. And so that as you start, you might start with these building blocks from the compassionate classroom and so forth, but you'll start bringing in your own ideas of how it works in your culture, in your school, and you'll make it your own, and then everybody will benefit.
Yeah, and I do know that it's very, very helpful to have a guided step-by-step, and it's one of the things that we're looking at right now in NVC for the next generation, that we create some sort of manual that has a list of the various activities that can happen.
That would be a very useful tool, I'm sure, for many. Thank you for sharing those resources, and we'll capture them and post them up for all the listeners, too, to be able to find those. It's great. A few more questions. One thing I wanted to add, too, is, not with nonviolent communication, but with all of these, our Teaching Peace in Schools track, the Peace Alliance has a peace-building cornerstone, and there's so many great things happening in schools. As you said, Jim, it's all very, in the ballpark of relation in terms of how these different things are working in schools. And what we're seeing, I just want everybody in the summit to hear this, what we're seeing in the data that's coming out of the classrooms that are implementing these kinds of programs, this sort of broad context of social and emotional learning, is that it's really changing the climate in the classrooms for the positive. It's making more stable well-being for the kids. It's actually increasing grade point averages. It's reducing truancy. The vision that, Jory, you shared, that you said this is the vision I want to see, which I loved, about what a classroom could look like, it may take us time to implement that and learn those skills to bring them to schools, but it would certainly pay for itself in emotional and financial ways for our schools to really seriously consider this stuff. So I just wanted to presence that.
Amen.
More questions?
Yes, we have a question from John. This is an important question. How would you suggest addressing...
Can I ask you a quick question before I... How many questions do we have so that we make sure we moderate our answers to get to as many as possible?
We have, I know, two more in the queue. Molly Roan Leach is managing them, so there may be others that she's polishing up, but there's at least two in the queue right now.
Okay,
thank you.
Perfect.
And just a reminder, folks, that you can submit them online, submit any questions. We're thrilled to have them. So this is from John. How would you suggest addressing issues of white supremacy as they manifest in schools? For instance, African-American students are disproportionately disciplined and receive harsher punishments than their white classmates. In my work, these are the kids that show up in our classes, referred by the school. How do we honestly express our understanding of what is happening while still maintaining our place in the school? That's a complex question.
Yeah, it's a question that is so key in the MVC training online community right now. We're looking at this whole idea of privilege, not just the whites and the blacks, but the privilege in lots of different ways. And I'm going to take it in perhaps a slightly different way, and instead of just what do we do when we go in there to try and do it, is how important it is that we start by mourning the needs that are not met by the particular structures that we have and the internal structures of this dominance and this loss of awareness about the wholeness of a particular person because we see them as so different. They're black and I'm white, and just the blind spots that we mourn, those blind spots until we really come down into what is very, very important to us, this sense of care for every human being, the needs we have for this level of inclusion, not because it's soft and warm and fuzzy, but that every pair of eyes sees a piece of this world that others are missing, and we need this kind of inclusion, really, to have the world we want to live in and to be as effective in the world and really get to the point where we get to what is at the heart of the matter that's missing in the way it is right now, and then come from the energy of these missing pieces, the unity, the love, the care, the compassion, whatever we're connecting to around this, and then make those the focal point. Make those the focal point so that we all get it, rather than making one group wrong and one group right. We can begin to really address what's important.
Yeah, similar answer for me. I'm actually one of the people on the planet that is among the most privileged. For many, many reasons. Of course, I was born white, and I'm financially stable. I live in Maui, for goodness sake. I don't think there's probably anybody on the planet that has more privilege than I have. And so the question is a very personal one for me. How can I address social inequality? And mourning is the first step for me. I grieve literally every day that this is the world that we live in. And then that awakens in me, this despair awakens in me a connection to my own power. What can I do about it? I'm actually one of the ones with structural power. So what can I, a person with privilege, do to address the unmet needs for those who are on the other end of the socioeconomic or whatever privilege scale that you want to use? So that's one of the things I'm so excited about what we're doing with NBC for the Next Generation, is that all of our programs are absolutely free. We have generous funding right now, and so we can make this program available to any parent who wants it. We're focusing on parents. We can make this program available to any teacher in Hawaii who wants it. We can make this available to any kid who wants it. Nobody has to pay. So that's one way that we can address it, is to figure out in our own lives, what can we do? How can we use our structural power that might be an accident of our own birth, but how can we use it to benefit those who temporarily have less until we can create a world with more equality and more equivalence? Because everybody's needs, as far as I can tell, have an equal value. I'm finished, Matthew, with that question.
Powerful, very powerful. Thank you. We have another question from Gia in San Diego. Many minority students, especially those in special education, are often left behind, punished, and not included in the same activities mainstream students participate in. How will restorative practices create a change in this area? With teachers who continue to use old punish first, isolate student practice versus a mindful and social emotional learning inclusion?
Yeah, this is almost like the ultimate question, right? How do we work within a system that actually is a hangover from a lot of old habits of power over and domination? In fact, every single person on this call, we all share the same education. We all share an education that's mostly unconscious in us, about looking at the world through this lens of what we were nicknaming Jackal earlier. And so that's one of the important parts of nonviolent communication for me is to begin to build a restorative system in ourselves as a necessary first step. So that then when we have as we begin to heal our own wounds around domination and submission and so forth, then we can show up with empathy for the teacher who is behaving out of their own paradigm, because we see that teacher is actually educated just the same way that I was, and she needs just as much empathy as I needed when I began to awaken to my how this domination was so deep in me. So that's always the first step for me, is to approach with empathy the person that is behaving in a way that is beyond what I would prefer. So to begin with empathy, to truly show up for the other person with an open heart. And then once a sense of connection is made, then we can begin to communicate. We can begin to educate on alternative ways of approaching inequality in any form, with some practical solutions about how to install more democracy in the classroom where there is an ethic of equivalence. And what I mean by an ethic of equivalence is to see that everybody's needs have an equal value, whether you are, whatever measurement you want to use in terms of learning disabilities or whatever, special needs, that just because you have that label doesn't mean you don't have needs. And so we keep our focus on the needs and not on the label.
I'd like to add a little something to this. Just take a moment. Because I feel the mourning inside of myself, right, in this moment of the systems that we have put together that are not addressing the needs of some of the people who need support the most. And every system we've put into place, I know, has been started with some positive intention, maybe a bit misguided, but still, everybody's been doing the best they know how to try to make things work. And this thought, this, call it a belief, if you will, just this, for me, it's like a realization that every single one of us is doing the best we know how to get our needs met. And every system we make is in the service of that. But we don't know what we don't know till we try something, and sometimes we just get stuck on the strategy and we stop learning. And so the systems, many of the systems we have, and especially schools, are power dynamics that are top down, coming down to someone here knows more, and so they make the decisions. And we miss where the real critical information is. And this became really quite clear to me when I was a mother. So I'll use this example, is that when I became a mother, I started reading avidly all these books. I kept figuring, where's the manual? Where's the manual? And I'd read one thing and they'd say this, and I'd read another thing and they'd say this, and it would say this. And there was a moment where I awoke to the reality that the manual is inside the child. If we really want to serve the kids who we have now labeled special ed, or whatever new label we use this week for how we try to compartmentalize the various needs of a community that's actually quite large. Schools are some of the largest communities to navigate. If we really want to figure out how to work with these kids, we stop and really hang out with, checking out what's going on inside of them. And then we'll come up with new answers instead of just keep trying to tweak the old domination approach.
the last thing I want to say about this is how much compassion I have for the people who are in the trenches every day.
Yeah.
For all the teachers who have devoted their life to serving our students. I have no doubt that every single one of them shows up every day doing the best they can to try to support our next generation. And my dream is that we learn how, as a society, to support our teachers so that they can support our kids. So if for all of you who have taught or are teaching now, please accept my heartfelt gratitude, for you're the ones who are actually doing this hard work every single day, day in and day out, often with nowhere near the resources that are required for you to do your jobs well. And so we need, as a society, to prioritize our needs. And we want to have safe schools with well-paid teachers who are able to really be present for their kids in a way so that the next generation can be the one that puts an end to violence as we know it now.
That's beautiful.
And Matthew, I think there was a second part of that question that we may not have addressed. The piece around the punishment of that.
Right, punishment and isolation.
Yeah, and particularly the racial piece in there, I think you mentioned in that question. And that we create enemy images in our, it's one of those things that happens that we see another as an enemy. And dissolving these enemy images within our society, finding ways to really see the humanity, is the answer to the violence. And rather than seeing someone as a black, an Asian, a white male, or, you know, as privileged, as, you know, all these different labels, the more we begin to see the humanity of each other, the less we'll be targeting certain people.
Yeah. If every child and adult learned these, not only the values but these tools, I can just only imagine what the world would be like. It could be really beautiful, and I think that you guys are leading the way, and we're just so grateful. I wish we had another hour to continue to soak this up and dialogue and learn, but you've given so much rich information tonight, and it's just a great pivot to with great resources too that people can get and learn more from. Is there a website that you? What is the website for your different organizations so that people can find it? Could you share that with us?
Sure. The Center for Nonviolent Communication is cnvc.org. The Center for Nonviolent Communication, C like in cat, nvc.org, and you'll find some trainings for educators that are happening this summer on that website. And then our website is NVC for Nonviolent Communication, NVC Next Gen, GEN.org.
That's great. Well, thank you both so much for all that you're doing, and we're looking forward to the course. For those who are going to take the course, you'll be instructors for one of the sessions there, and that'll be a great way to learn more. And we'll just continue to look at all this and see how we can keep moving it forward. Thank you.
You're truly welcome. Truly beautiful.
Thank you.
All right.
I can't figure out who's the giver or the receiver here. It's really
quite. I like to double up on my appreciation. Well. So it's so great. It's such a great pivot to this upcoming course that we're so excited about that's coming up. You know, as we've been talking about our educational system, you know, it can be the cause of a lot of anxiety for our youth, as well as parents and teachers and educators and principals and social workers, people who've devoted their life mission to helping kids open up and not close to our world. to help kids really learn to be successful and honoring of their own unique gifts. And that's why, at the Peace Alliance and NACRJ, we really believe that we have to work to transform our school systems to embody these emotional and relational aspects of learning and employ restorative processes much more widely. And that's why we're so excited about the launch of this new virtual course. It's going to start next Wednesday, February 10th, and it ends in mid-April. It will feature faculty and guides who are really leading practitioners in this field. This is, as you've heard tonight, with Jim and Jory, and Monday with Dominic Barter and Kamisha Fatima Gentry. They're doing truly remarkable work within the education field with our youth. And we're just thrilled to be kicking this off. It's an inaugural program for us, and we hope you'll seriously look at it. You can learn more on our website, and you can register there. It's at peacealliance.org/teachpeacecourse. It's peacealliance.org/teachpeacecourse. And just learn more. There's a lot of great information. And there's faculty from all over the world, which is exciting. There's people doing great work everywhere. So please do check that out. And you can also learn a lot more about this kind of work, as I mentioned earlier, through our Teaching Peace in Schools Peace Building Cornerstone on our website, which is peacealliance.org/teachpeace. There's lots of great resources, different kinds of curriculum and programs that are happening in schools, links to organizations, statistics on how effective these kinds of programs are. So plenty to learn from there. So that would be great. I want to welcome now, you may have heard from him for just a second earlier, our president of the Peace Alliance, Bob Baskin, to just share a little bit with us about the Peace Alliance, for those of you who aren't familiar. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Matt. Well, thank you, Matt. And really, thank you so much, Jim and Jory, and in his absence, Congressman Ryan. I mean, I don't know what I'm more excited about, the ability of these tools from mindfulness and nonviolent communication and social and emotional learning to provide our kids with the tools of that will help them learn better and do better in school, or whether I'm more excited about the ability of these tools to prepare them for life. I mean, and I know that these two aspects are clearly related and correlated, but boy, what a wonderful session this has been, and I want to thank all of you, and particularly those who have taken the time, made the time to listen in tonight and to join in and to ask questions and so on. We are so proud of you and our network. But for those of you who are new and who don't know very much about the work of the Peace Alliance, we are a grassroots educational and advocacy organization focused on really transforming how individuals and communities and even nations respond to conflict and violence. We work to demonstrate that prevention and intervention solutions that we promote have been proven effective in saving lives and dollars while enhancing cooperation skills and increasing social resilience. We work very hard to champion evidence-based peace-building legislation and policies by encouraging our policymakers and the media and the public to support these conflict and violence reduction approaches. We focus specifically on five key peace-building cornerstones, some of which you've heard a little bit about tonight, certainly teaching peace in schools. But in addition to that, we focus on the cornerstone of empowering community peace building and of humanizing our justice systems and fostering international peace. And of course, and you heard some of this with Congressman Ryan's talk about mindfulness, cultivating personal peace within ourselves. We feel confident that with the help of people like you, we can really shift our culture in a positive new direction. And you can learn much more about, you've heard a lot of websites tonight, but you can learn much more about the work in general of the Peace Alliance and specifically to the discussion tonight at www.peacealliance.org. Again, I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight. We certainly hope that you will seriously consider the upcoming course. It's going to be truly an incredible faculty that's going to be involved, and you will learn so much. We are so confident of that. We're all looking forward to it. I want you to have a great day and whatever is left of it, and we really hope to see you when the course begins. So thank you all so much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Appreciate that. And, you know, our other partner for this series is the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice. And for those of you who aren't aware, they're such a great organization, one of the big hubs for restorative justice in the nation and maybe even world. They employ principles of social and restorative justice, seeking transformation in the ways justice questions are addressed. They promote effective forms of justice that are equitable, sustainable, and socially constructive. NACRJ serves as the parent organization for the biannual National Conference on Restorative Justice and provides members with information, resources applicable to restorative and community justice theory and practice. And their website is nacrj.org, and they're just such that's a tremendous resource as well. So check them out. Their next conference is going to be in Oakland next year, and they're really powerful, amazing experiences to come together with lots of other folks doing this work. So thank you all for coming. I just want to remind you, we're going to be sending out the audio for this call very soon. It will be posted on that main webpage. I'll hopefully have it up tonight. I apologize that some of the folks couldn't get into the system. We know that there were some issues, and some of you may have come on later and not gotten the first part, but we will get the audio posted ASAP, and you can download an MP3 or stream it, so that will be available. But thank you all for joining us. It really is a powerful, beautiful that we can co-create together. It's already happening. There are many people creating it, but you know, let's take it to the next level and really make this our norm. That would be a beautiful thing for the planet. Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening. For anybody listening to this on the recording, thanks for listening. And don't forget to check out our course. Have a good one.